This is Jim Inkster. You open today. I'm sure many will recognize Johnny's theme, the instrumental jazz song played as the opening of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson from 1962 through 1992, composed by Paul Anka and Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson made his debut as the host of The Tonight Show October 1, 1962. Ordinarily, we would do it on the actual anniversary, but it is on Saturday, so we're 2 days ahead. But the man who's kept the flame alive, Henry Bushkin, the biographer of Johnny Carson, his lawyer, and at one time his closest friend, as said by Mr. Carson. Henry Bushkin went to work for Johnny Carson a few years after the debut in New York City and joined him when the show moved to Los Angeles in 1972. Johnny Carson dominated late-night television and is arguably the biggest star in the history of the medium. Unfortunately, 30 years have passed since he did his last show, and many people under 30 have no idea who Johnny Carson was, but he was the biggest star in the galaxy for more than a few decades, and Henry Bushkin was along for the ride during some years at the end of the trail when Johnny Carson, of course, was growing tired of being as famous and under the spotlight in the zone where people are scrutinized for everything they do, and he decided to call it a day in 1992. But Henry Bushkin, it's always a pleasure to have you join us, and remember the great Johnny Carson.
Jim, thanks very much. It's a delight being with you today.
And Henry has written two books about the man for whom he worked. The one that was a bestseller a few years back, Johnny Carson, with Johnny's familiar face on the cover, is soon to be followed by Good to Be King, in which Henry goes back and unearths many nuggets of information. We had Henry on the show in May, talking about the early years of John William Carson, Pride of Nebraska, who was educated both at the University of Nebraska and at Millsaps College, served in the United States Armed Forces in World War II, was a boxer, may have suffered from CTE, and in his later years relied heavily upon the bottle to keep himself going. But few people knew about the torment behind the talent, and there was an ample amount of both of those, wasn't there?
Sure. Well, he had a difficult mother in the sense that nothing that he could do ever really pleased her, and I think throughout his life that troubled him. And obviously on the air it didn't affect him, but I think off the air it did affect him.
Henry Bushkin with us, the author of two books about Johnny Carson, soon to be Good to Be King will be available, and he has written prolifically and has information about this amazing entertainer that few people have. And a reminder that signature support for our program is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet, and your number is 877-217-5757. Robin Dow producing, and Robin has pulled up a remembrance of the date October 1st, 1962. Johnny was in New York City, NBC. He was doing an hour and a half then. Later the show would be condensed to 1 hour. But here's a remembrance of what happened six decades ago when John Kennedy was president, and the world was a different place.
October 1st, 1962 is a day I'll always remember. I was 36 years old, taking my place as host of America's most popular late-night program, The Tonight Show.
From New York, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. Johnny's guests tonight are Joan Crawford, Rudy Valley, Tony Bennett, Mel Brooks, the Phoenix Singers, Skitch Anderson, me. I'm Ed McMahon. Right now, let's welcome the fellow you waited 6 months to see.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. This is kind of an emotional thing for me because I've known about this show for a long time. And the newspapers and the magazines, and I've probably been interviewed 150 times in the last 9 months since I've known about this. As I say, you work up to it. We come over here this afternoon. We meet the guests that are on the show. And you get kind of charged up. I don't mean to be maudlin about it. But I know that tonight a lot of people, a lot of my friends are watching all over the country. And I only have one feeling as I stand here knowing that so many people are watching. I want my man there.
Well, I made it through that first night with the help of Groucho Marx, Rudy Valli, Joan Crawford, Tony Bennett, and Mel Brooks.
And Johnny always had the A-list of guests, and Henry, you were with him a few years later, and by then he was the biggest star in television. How was that experience for a young guy fresh out of Vanderbilt Law School?
Well, actually, it was 1970, and the show was still in New York. And actually, when the show started in 1962, Jim, it was an hour and 45 minutes, then reduced to 90 minutes, ultimately reduced to an hour. And so when I joined him in 1970, I was a nervous wreck because I was a young lawyer and he was a major star already 8 years on The Tonight Show. So for me at the beginning, I was just a nervous wreck figuring what's a young lawyer doing, representing or being even near this major star.
And being Johnny Carson's lawyer meant being with him at all hours, and he was a creature of the night. And you're a young guy, and of course you're hanging out with the biggest star in the galaxy. And a listener asked before, I'm going to ask you a question about your first night with Carson, but you've been a few years, you've told it on this show. But well, how did you get the gig? How did you get the job?
Johnny had been doing benefits for the Police Benevolent Association. And a friend of mine was a photographer, a police photographer, and he became friendly with Johnny at these events. And Johnny confided in him that he was having problems with his wife, and he didn't trust lawyers as such. And this mutual friend suggested me as a lawyer who was, quote, uncorruptible. I was so new. So that's how I was introduced to Johnny as this young lawyer. And I was amazed that after I met him, I actually got a call from him to come down and meet him. So it was quite shocking for me to get the gig, as they say.
Right. And your first night on the job is reported in the remarkable book, the biography, Johnny Carson. You went on a adventure that you did not anticipate.
Exactly. I was actually hired because he had planned with a few buddies of his, including a private investigator, and the same guy who introduced me to Johnny Arthur Castell, he was planning to raid an apartment in his neighborhood because the word was that his wife, Joanne, had secretly kept an apartment a few blocks away from their residence at UN Plaza. So I was brought along as the lawyer in case the cops came because of this potential break-in to this other apartment.
And you did break in.
We did. Actually, we didn't have to break in because $300 or $400 to the superintendent of the building got us the key, and then we just entered the apartment. And of course, it was sort of tragic to find his wife having this secret apartment where she was carrying on an affair with a rather well-known individual at the time.
Frank Gifford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Frank Gifford. And Johnny, of course, was not happy, as any man would be and not be. He wouldn't be happy about having his wife with another man. And he was emotional about it, wasn't he?
It was the only time I really saw him physically in a state of hysteria, crying. And And obviously, for all of us, it was just a terrible scene to see this, you know, sort of a heroic guy, this major star, breaking down. But I think any person, man or woman, probably would have had the same reaction had you found your wife or your husband having an affair with another person. And that's exactly what happened. But that lasted about a day and a half for him, and he was over it. A day and a half later, he was on to other things.
And soon, this was the second ex, Mrs. Carson. But Henry Bushkin was with Johnny when he remarried, and two more times. And he has an amazing story about the life and times of the greatest star in the history of the small screen. And we'll be back with more in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number's 877-217-5757. Robin Dow producing, and we're visiting with one of our favorites. He visits with us at least once a year these days, Henry Bushkin, who's keeping the flame alive about the great entertainer Johnny Carson. He's now been off the air as long as he was on, and he was on 30 years. It all started October 1, 1962. You heard Carson say he was 36 years old. Johnny Carson was born in Nebraska in 1925, October 23rd, and he died January 23rd, 2005. He was 79 years old. One of the ironies, the other day I was mentioning Jack LaLanne. He died also on January 23rd, 10 years later. And, he died in 2011, 6 years after Carson. And in 2021, Larry King died on January 23rd. So three of the biggest stars in the history of television died on the 23rd day of January. But Johnny Carson was the biggest of them all. And I really don't think it's a contest, but it is a great irony for people of our age, Henry, who encounter young people who are in the know about so many things that we're not, but they know nothing about Johnny Carson. And I commend you for keeping the flame alive.
Thank you. You know, I think I mentioned the other day that I went back and watched some of the early shows, namely some of the Kraft music halls where Carson was the guest, and others where Carson was the MC. And it's amazing, Jim, how funny things were in those days, how these comedians back in the early 60s and through the 60s, the humor was so good and so funny, without language. There was no toilet jokes, and it's sort of refreshing to go back and watch these things, because these comedians in those days were so genuinely funny, and it's completely different today. It's completely different today, and to watch those early shows, you get a great sense of how the humor was and how things have changed in the 60 years since Carson started. And if you go back in the 60s and you watch some of those shows, you could enjoy the humor that we just don't have today. The late night shows just do not have that today, like they used to with Johnny and the other shows. When Milton Berle was on the air, when Alan King was around, when Jerry Lewis was around, Don Rickles, Henny Youngman, we don't have that today, and it's sad. And it would be nice to find a way to resurrect that.
Well, often we find out how good someone was at their craft by what happens when they leave, and since Carson's left, there really has been nobody in his league. There have been some good people, and obviously don't get a job like that without talent. Jay Leno had ample talent, but he was no Johnny Carson. I think we both would agree on that, Henry.
And the same for David Letterman. I mean, Carson founded David Letterman. Carson gave him his first big shot, and Letterman was on the air for probably 20 or 25 years.
Actually a little longer than that, but he...
And still never reached the level of Carson.
No, and the truth is that Letterman had plaudits from reviewers who appreciated his talent, and he was different. He was kind of personality you don't often see, but he never reached Jay Leno in the ratings. He was defeated roundly by Leno, who, of course, was a, kind of a journeyman comic who got the big gig and did the best he could with it, and he did pretty well, but he was no Johnny Carson. Dan Downtown. Dan, you're on with Henry Bushkin.
Yeah, Mr. Bushkin, do you know if Carson had any affairs of his own, like with guests, you know, like Carol Wayne? I can only say I could assure you the answer is yes. He and Angie Dickinson were very good friends. He and Ann Margaret had a relationship for quite some time. There were others, but also back in the day, infidelity was never looked at as anything that was going to hamper your career. Okay, in those days, and I might add that all the major male stars from Bob Hope on down were all guilty of it. Okay, and again, it was a different time, different environment. That would never happen today. Okay, but also you don't have the humor and the personalities today that existed back then during the what I call the golden age of comedy. When comedians were really funny, when Henny Youngman was really funny, when Rodney Dangerfield was hysterical, Milton Berle, Jerry Lewis, Alan King.
Well, Carson, you noted in our conversation the other day that you were with him, and obviously you went where the boss went. And in 1972, less than 2 years after you went to work for Carson, he says, "We're leaving New York. We're going to Los Angeles." And Henry, by the way, has moved back to New York, and it is a city with a pulse that's different than Los Angeles, even though Los Angeles is the entertainment capital of the world. But was that why he went there, perhaps to get better guests?
Absolutely. In 1972, the entertainment world was shifting from New York-centric, Los Angeles-centric, and it really had to do with the better availability of guests and a different lifestyle for Johnny, where he had a big house with tennis court, swimming pool, lots of property, lots of privacy, and he was much happier in L.A. than he was in New York. But eventually, like many, bought an apartment back. Actually, bought two apartments back in New York. So he never really left the city, but he loved living in Los Angeles and then in Malibu.
And a listener notes from our previous conversation, he had been there before. He actually had a show, the Johnny Carson Show, in Los Angeles before he went to New York. And that's a sharp guy who wrote, this is Howlin' Monroe. He notes that Carson, as you described, was, believe it or not, a friend of James Dean. And tomorrow it will be 67 years since James Dean died. And Carson, I think, was with him the night before he was killed in that car accident, wasn't he?
Absolutely. At a restaurant called the Villa Capri in Hollywood, which Frank Sinatra owned half of it, by the way. And in the day, 1955, that was the place to be, the Villa Capri. And Carson, in 1955, had his own television show. It was a CBS network show. So in 1955, he was a minor growing television star. James Dean was a major star, although very, very shy. And Carson, in effect, out in the public, was also shy. And they had a good relationship in 1955. and they were both living there, and it was tragic. Dean, the next day when he did die, was on his way to a race up in Salinas, California, and tragically had that accident. But Carson was there the night before, as were many others. And again, it was just a tragic event in late September 1955. So it was almost, 67 years ago today?
Tomorrow.
That it happened tomorrow.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Henry Bushkin, the author of Johnny Carson and Good to Be King, about Mr. Carson, who began his 30-year reign on The Tonight Show as host October 1, 1962, 60 years ago. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased you're with us for Talk Louisiana. Mark Mallard will be joining us from the nation's capital in just a bit. But we do have some folks waiting to talk with Henry Bushkin, the author of Johnny Carson and Good to Be King, about the man for whom he worked for some time. He joined Johnny Carson in 1970, was with him when Carson moved The Tonight Show to Los Angeles in 72. And 20 of the 30 years that Carson was on the air, it came from Los Angeles, California, Burbank. And the studios were not in an area that was opulent, such as the one where Carson lived. Henry just described it. In Bel Air, he lived next door almost to Jerry Lewis, two of the biggest mansions in one of the most splendid places in the world. And Carson was living the life, but he had, as we know, four marriages, all of which were troubled. He had a troubled relationship with his mother, and underneath the exterior, the great comic had many demons, and Henry Bushkin saw them. But on the whole, I think you have come to the conclusion that he was a good man, Henry.
Absolutely. I think when you understand the physiology, first of all, of boxing and being in the Navy and being in 10 three-round bouts and getting hit in the head enough times, the modern equivalent of football players, I believe that the traumatic brain injury over 20 or 25 years caused headaches, caused personality changes, caused mood swings, and caused him to self-isolate once that show was over. So I do believe that there was physical impairment that caused a number of these personality issues. But overall, he was a generous guy. He was a good guy. And in the day, and when I'm talking about in the day, when The Tonight Show was really, standing on its own two feet, when it was the biggest thing in the world, Carson was a guy that you wanted to hang out with. Carson was the funniest guy in the room if he wanted to be. And he was the most important guy in the room if he wanted to be. And so, I think overall you'd have to say he was basically a very good guy whose personality changed over the years. It's really that simple.
Well, Bill Huey asks about brawl that Carson apparently was in at Jilly's. And as we know, he had other fistic encounters, and he was probably saved from himself. He, of course, was a guy who was even not big, but he was in shape, and he had a mean streak. He probably could have inflicted some great damage on some of these combatants, including Tom Snyder, who wanted no part of Johnny Carson. But you were there for some of those, weren't you?
Right. The Jilly's incident happened because Johnny was drinking one night, and he happened to pick on the wrong young lady at the bar, who happened to be the wife of Joey Gallo. And so that led to some difficulties for him. And Jilly, who was Frank Sinatra's pal, Jilly actually stopped these two, I call them no-necks. They were so big that you couldn't see their necks. That's how big these guys were. And they could have put a good beating on them, but Jilly stopped it and actually saved the day for Johnny.
Quickly, let's go through a few callers who've been waiting to talk to Mr. Henry Bushkin, the bombastic Bushkin. Chuck and Scott. Chuck, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, on a lighter note, and you just kind of referenced it, Johnny seemed to frequently make references or jokes to, about his lawyer, Bombastic Bushkin, and I wondered if he talked about those with you in advance or if you were ever invited on the show.
The answer to both is no. I was never on the show. And he would tell me after the joke or after the bit about a Bombastic Bushkin line, and he would tell that to me after the show so I could alert my parents, who were then living in Florida, to watch the show that evening, because the show obviously finished at 6:30 and it didn't go on the air until 11:30. So he would give me notes about these lines so I could let my mother know. That was basically how he let me know.
Mike in Waveland, Mississippi. Mike, you're on with Henry Bushkin. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Jim and Henry. I'm wondering about Tom Snyder. I've never heard that before, that they were at odds with each other.
Johnny, for whatever the reason, didn't like Tom Snyder, and Tom Snyder had a show that went on after Johnny's, and it was one night at a restaurant at Chasen's. It was after the Emmy Awards, and Johnny, for many years, Johnny was up for Emmys for best writers, for best show, and didn't win. Okay, and this was one of those nights, and we were sitting at Chasen's after the Emmy Awards show, and there was Tom Snyder, and Carson was drinking, and he was staring at Tom Snyder, and they were both staring at each other. And several of us, Ed McMahon and myself and Bobby Quinn, who was the director of The Tonight Show, had a step in between the two of them so there was no fisticuffs at Chasen's restaurant. It had to be around 1974 and 1975.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Henry. Hi, Randy.
Yes, I can remember on several occasions he had Jack Benny and Jimmy Stewart on many, many times.
Yeah, he had all the biggies, and he was friends with most of those people too, wasn't he, Henry?
And Jack Benny was an idol of his. He loved Jack Benny. And yeah, Jimmy Stewart, Jack Benny were major stars in the day, and he loved having them on.
Mm-hmm. As we part, another listener says, we can't get through our conversation with you without mentioning Mateo's. That was the center of the universe on Sunday nights on Westwood Boulevard in Los Angeles near the campus of UCLA. How was that experience?
Well, I should mention that I'm married to Jackie Jordan, who owned Mateo's. She was married at the time to Matty Jordan, who was a good friend of mine in the day. And so I'm very familiar with Mateo's. And Mateo's, on a Sunday night in the 70s and the 80s, Mateo's was the place to be. And so Mateo's was quite famous in the day, and Carson loved it. Frank Sinatra was there every Sunday night. Frank Sinatra was a good friend of my wife, Jackie Jordan, and Matty Jordan, and everybody went to Mateo's. It was the center of the universe for a while.
Well, Lucille Ball was a regular on Sunday nights too, wasn't she?
At Lucille Ball, Marvin Davis, Kirk Kerkorian, you name it. Everybody wanted a table at Mateo's on a Sunday evening.
And Johnny Carson and Frank Sinatra. My goodness. Well, Henry, thanks for sharing your memories of the great Johnny Carson. We'll be calling again soon. Always a pleasure.
Delightful. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon. And now we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Mark Ballard, who in not so distant past was joining us from the state capitol. He's now at the nation's capitol. How's the vibe there today, Mark?
Well, they're going to get back to being busy today after taking a couple of days off. But then they're taking off for the rest of the fall to campaign. So the vibe here is expectant and excited, and they're, you know, just like it is before any vacation.
Well, we're 40 days away from the midterms. I think most prognosticators believe that Republicans will regain the House, although it's not a given, but it's probably 75% likely. And then the Senate's about 50-50. Well, if the House is regained by the Republicans, that means Steve Scalise is number two in the pecking order behind Kevin McCarthy of California, who, of course, is a guy who's not everybody's cup of tea. So is Scalise on a track to become Speaker of the House?
Well, of course, he will say no way, no how, that, you know, he's got the job that he wants. But it does appear that, you know, if McCarthy stumbles, then he's the guy. Now, remember that he got his job as whip when, out of the blue, Eric Cantor from Richmond had been lost his election. And so he was the guy right behind Cantor and stepped into that job. So, I mean, there's been history for this. And I guess we're going to find out pretty soon.
And Scalise has a charisma about him. He is a guy who is an ardent Republican. I don't think there's any doubt that he is one of the most right-wing members of Congress. And he has worked hard to get where he is. And it is ironic that congressional seat has been held by previously Bobby Jindal and David Vitter, and Bob Livingston. I mean, it's really been a launching pad, hasn't it?
It has, primarily because it kind of covers the New Orleans suburbs, which is basically where the Republican Party in Louisiana started and found its base and found its footing. And so, yeah, it's a he has a good seat, but he also has done a lot of work in the trenches by helping out colleagues get elected to the House and supporting their campaigns as well.
877-217-5757, a quarter hour to go with the remarkable Mark Ballard, now at the nation's capital, where he is covering national and local politics. And as we know, Louisiana is generally right in the middle of everything. We're back after this with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana, and is our Thursday tradition. Joining us now from Washington at the nation's capital is Mark Ballard, who is one of the best reporters in America, who calls Louisiana his home base. He is the ace reporter for the Advocate and Picayune and ran the Capitol Bureau office in Baton Rouge for many, many, many years. Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana, you're on with Mark. Good morning, Henry.
Morning, Mr. Jim. Morning, Mr. Mark. Mr. Mark, I'm glad you made it up there to D.C. in one piece, so give them hell while you're up there. I got a question. Since Louisiana, as well as the United States and quite a few other states, are sending money and resources to Florida to help with the storm cleanup like we should, and especially considering all the dead people that sheriff said they had over there, I was wondering if maybe Governor DeSantis would find his way clear to use some of that $12 million he has allocated to pluck up migrants and send them up to Democratic states.
Loaded question from Henry.
I think that Governor DeSantis has kind of put all of that sort of politics on hiatus for the time being, as has President Biden, and they're both working together to kind of deal with this crisis, which we are all too familiar with in Louisiana.
Mark on Highland. Mark, you're on with the other Mark. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning. Every president gets a physical exam at least once a year. Have we heard anything about our President Biden's latest physical?
Well, he had one last year, but I don't think he's had one yet this year, but I'm sure it'll be reported. But Mark, are you there? The other Mark?
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything about it. Well, you know, they did a cognitive exam as well, and some people may be surprised, but yes, Joe Biden is all there, and he moves slowly, and that was noted in his last physical that he has some arthritic issues, and he is, as of November 20th, he will be 80 years old. He's not overweight. He's certainly not obese, but he's showing signs of wear and tear, and that should be a concern. Mark, we have this age limit. You got to be 35 to be president, but you can be 105 and be president if the people of America elect you, or if you win in the Electoral College. You think there might be a good idea to have a limit on the other side? Make it, I don't know, pick the age, 85, 80, 75. What do you think?
Well, we do it in the state with you know, Supreme Court justices and that sort of thing. But I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that if you're old enough, if you're healthy enough to do it, then should we really put a limit on it? I mean,
well,
other countries, they also have very old leaders. I just don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And people, of course, are living longer and they're in better shape. And in Biden's case, despite the attacks, there is no evidence that he's losing his mind. He stutters, but he always has. He's all there.
Yeah.
And I would like to see it where if you're 21 or 18, you could run for president. I don't know why we have a limit on the front end. That might spur more young voters to be participants in elections if we had really young candidates. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ballard, how could it be Louisiana, given Louisiana's a poor state, every Republican representing Louisiana and Washington voted for the unfunded Trump tax cuts that added almost $8 trillion to the national debt, and yet every Republican representative from Louisiana and Washington voted for a measure that would have capped diabetics buying insulin at $35 a month? How could Louisiana vote for people that only care for the rich and greedy?
All right. David believes that priorities are out of whack for the Republican Party. Of course, we have a guy on deck, Patrick Inniswald, who probably believes just the opposite. But, Mark, this is an age-old debate we've had.
It is. And in a democracy, the majority rules, and the majority has ruled that that's the way they want to go. These are the candidates they want to have.
Patrick in Inniswald Estates. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, y'all were talking about Biden's competency, and the caller asked about, you know, if it's physical. But, I mean, what's really alarming is Joe Biden, just at this food conference, I think it was yesterday or the day before, he asked if Jackie Wachowski, how could he not know that she had been killed in a car accident? I mean, he's asking for her publicly in a conference. It's very alarming. You know, if George Bush had done something like this, we would have never heard the end of it.
Well, and George Bush, as we know, did make some gaffes, both George Bushes. But it's fair game when somebody says something stupid, like when George Bush said, "Is our children learning?" But Mark Ballard, we haven't elected really smart people to be president, in my view, in the last several outings. The last one was Clinton, who I think was a guy with an extremely high IQ. But most of them are probably in like the, you know, 110, 120 range, meaning they're smarter than the average Joe or the average Jim, but they're not geniuses.
Yeah, and people make mistakes all the time. I mean, I can't. Boy, if every time I made a misstatement, it was brought up to me and ground down on it, I probably would not leave my house because I just think that that's something that people do. And you're right. I mean, we've not really elected too many Thomas Jeffersons. You know,
what was it John Kennedy said when several members of Congress were in the room with him and said the intellectual equivalency was when Thomas Jefferson was dining alone. Tom on Blue Bonnet, he makes a point. He says President Obama was a pretty smart guy, and I won't quarrel with that. James and Metairie, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mark. What are you hearing up there in D.C. about, you know, the next Democratic candidate for president? Is it Kamala Harris or this Gavin Newsom out in California, who seems to have a lot of charisma and certainly could go battle and fight to fight with Ron DeSantis if he turns out to be the
Republican candidate? Newsom was married to Kimberly Guilfoyle, who's Don Jr.'s girlfriend, so I'm sure that would be an interesting matchup if he ran, Governor Newsom ran against President Trump. But the question was to you, Mark.
Well, up here, what you're hearing primarily is from you know, the pundit class, and both of those names have been trotted out. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that the president has indicated that he wants to run for re-election. Now, whether he will or not, I don't know. If he does not, then he freezes the field, which tends to help his vice president. But I mean, right now, I guess we got to take him at his word that he wants to do this. But there's still a lot of chatter about prominent Democrats looking at a presidential run.
And the listener notes a story I think was told on this show about when Buddy Romer was driving to Franklin to visit with Governor Foster about endorsing Governor Jindal as the successor to Mike Foster. Romer said he saw on the road, he saw a bumper sticker that said, "We already tried smart once." So he said this to Foster. He said, "I saw this weird bumper sticker. We already tried smart once." And Foster responded to Romer, "I hate it when they talk about me like that." So there you go.
Well, you have to be somewhat intelligent to get yourself in a position to be, you know, governor or president or senator.
Right. But if we were to do IQ tests, I think we've had some extremely smart governors, including the current one. But Romer was a brilliant guy. Edwards, the other one, was a brilliant guy. Jindal was a brilliant guy. We've had some really, really smart people be governor of Louisiana, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were good governors. But speaking of, the congressional race, Holden Hoggett is considered the primary challenger at this point with 40 days to go to Clay Higgins. And Hoggett showing some creativity under the wing of his political consultant, Mary Patricia Ray, has done a parody about Clay Higgins, who made his name as the Crime Stoppers reporter. Here's the spot for Holden Hoggett.
I'm Holden Hoggett, and I approve this message.
In 2016, a fraud was elected to Congress. The perpetrator, Clay Higgins, remains at large and is wanted for putting a gun to his wife's head, threatening her if she divorced him, and refusing to pay child support for 17 years. He was last seen impersonating a congressman while voting against fixing the roads you drive on and abandoning hurricane victims. If you have a vote that could lead to his defeat, use it and elect Holden Hoggett to Congress. Your vote will remain anonymous, and Louisiana will be rewarded.
And Jeff Palermo, Louisiana Radio Network News Director, has gotten a response just a few moments ago from Congressman Higgins. Here's Clay Higgins.
No, I don't pay attention to political attacks and ads, man. I don't even like politicians. I don't even consider those citizens to be opponents. They're not my opponents, Jeff. They're my constituents. They're confused. And I'm just going to keep working. They can do what they want and say what they want. I have a job to do and a nation to serve and 750,000 constituents.
All right. Unfortunately, we've got to roll, but Mark, we'll call next week, and I'll be eager to get your take on this race and more. Thank you, my friend.
Okay.
Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet.